Oh, it is Shattered Mirror. Yeah,
oh,
okay.
look, Paul's right again.
Wait, is that supposed to be impersonation of me? Are you mocking me?
Yeah, I'm mocking you. What are you going to do about it?
He mocks me. He mocks me and I shall have him.
Yeah, he's mocking me.
I'm Captain Benjamin Sisko. Welcome to Deep Space Nine.
Red alert! All crew members report to battle stations.
Red alert. Shields up.
What shields?
Your Starfleet officers! Now start acting like it!
Oh, it's just Garak. Plain, simple, Garak.
Dax, we might have just discovered the first stable wormhole known to exist.
The wormhole does bring them our way, doesn't it?
Everyone wants a piece of the new frontier.
This will shortly become a leading center of commerce and of scientific exploration. And for Starfleet, one of our most important posts.
Quite a motley crew you've assembled here, Benji.
Listen to The Prophets, a Deep Space Nine podcast.
And here are your hosts, Andrew Leyland, Paul Spataro, and Dr. Bill Robinson.
Bloody hell.
But maybe we should do the show.
Okay.
Here's the show. Ba-ba-ba-da-ba-ba. Deep Space Nine is on tonight. And oh, what wormholes will hit. On with the show, this is it.
And that was the introduction to yet another episode of Listen to the Prophet, a Deep Space Nine podcast, a Two True Freaks presentation. We are your podcast guide to every episode of Deep Space Nine. I am just ripping off my intro to the other show. I am Andrew Leyland, and as ever, I am joined by two absolutely wonderful examples of manhood. Bill Robinson.
I'm just an implanted memory.
And Paul Spataro.
Hi-o.
He's not an implanted memory. Today's show...
He's just a half-saved...
Why do I have this memory of killing him?
He's just a half-saved loaf of bread.
Today's show is about Deep Space Nine, Season 4, Episode 19, Hard Time, which is the annual Let's Give Chief O'Brien a Hard Time episode, hence the title. But before that, let us discuss this month's Star Trek news. We need a jingle. Excellent. As we record this,
not the best Foley artist in the business for nothing.
He's not the best Foley artist in the business.
Hey, right here.
As we record this, Discovery is off the air, so we don't have any news about Discovery other than it's coming back in January. And there has been no...
And by the time you hear this, it will already have come back and probably finished up.
Which is why I don't see the point of doing a news section, but it's apparently become part of the show, so fair enough.
It's in your contract.
It's in my contract, sir. And there is no further movement on Star Trek 4, or the new Star Trek 4. Would it be 14 in reality?
Well, let's see. There were 6 with the original series. Then there was Generations of 7, First Contact 8, Insurrection 9, Nemesis 10, so this would be 14, yeah.
So there has been no movement whatsoever on that, even though, as we know from the third one, all the cast are signed up, as is apparently Chris Hemsworth.
What?
Apparently they got in touch with Chris Hemsworth return to play Chris Pine's dad, because there are enough people named Chris involved in these movie franchises.
Now, I've been a defender of this series, but if in this fourth movie, if they go back and save the whales, I'm done. There will be the last movie with this crew that I watch.
Are you saying that Chris Pine and Chris Hemsworth are whales?
No.
Okay, good.
Maybe they're club whales, I don't know.
Yeah, I think it would be a real shame. I personally think that what happened with Star Trek Beyond was the precursor to what's happened with Justice League, that the damage was done by the previous film and lots of people just didn't turn out for the third one, even though it is demonstrably a better and more enjoyable movie.
I agree.
So I think it would be a shame if we don't get a fourth one.
But they need to build on what they did already.
Yes, they need to take the template of the third one and move forward with it and go back to exploring strange new worlds like the third one did. Let's not rely on what we've done previously. The whole point of rebooting this was so that we could boldly go again. And it seems to me that the first two weren't really bothered about that, whereas Beyond was. So I think it would be a shame if the people who wrote Beyond didn't get a chance to take that further and do the fourth one, which was Simon Pegg. Simon Pegg was involved in the scripting of the third one. And I think it's the best Star Trek movie since The Undiscovered Country. I really do enjoy that third new Trek movie.
See, unlike some of our brethren, I am a big fan of First Contact.
Yeah, I like First Contact. I
still think that was superior to this.
Do you? Because my thinking is, I don't think The Next Generation ever translated to movies as well or as easily as the original cast did.
I think it's not, because there was more of a separation in between the show and...
Yeah, and there was more of a progression in the original cast movies as well. It felt like they were doing something.
In order to go to the movies, they had to turn Patrick Stewart into an action movie star, which he really isn't.
No.
And I think that was part of the problem with the Next Generation movies. But I thought it still worked in First Contact. I thought they gave everybody a little, you know, a little time in the spotlight. I thought, you know, basically the zombie plot line worked very well for them. The time travel, I thought, worked. I enjoyed that movie a lot, and I know a lot of people are critical of it on, you know, in our group. But that is one of my favorites, so I would still rank that for me personally over Star Trek Beyond, which I also liked a lot.
No, that's fair enough. I'd like to say I just think The Next Generation didn't translate as well, and I don't know why that would be. And as such, I don't think that the movies were ever as good as the original guys. Even the bad original guys ones. Or bad in inverted commas, because I'd love Star Trek the Motion Picture, I think had something to say or were doing something that they hadn't already done.
Now, when I think bad for the original cast, I start thinking about the Final Frontier.
Yeah, that is the worst one.
But even then, there are things in that movie that I enjoy.
Yeah, it's the Superman 4 of the franchise. It's easily the worst one, but it's not unenjoyable.
See, we've had a talk in the past about guilty pleasures.
And
I think I was talking to Scott one day about it, and he was like, "Nah, screw that. I don't ever feel guilty for something I enjoy." And I was like, "Well, that's not how I define it, because I don't feel guilty for something I enjoy either. But to me, guilty pleasure is something that you know is really not so good, but you like it anyway.
Yeah,
I don't feel guilty about it. It's just, you know, the way I define it. And I know The Final Frontier is not very good, but I enjoy it." And that's all there is to it. So I guess, you know, it falls under the range of guilty pleasure for me.
Yeah.
Hey, no, is this your veiled attempt to say to me that Xanadu is not a good movie?
Well, I really wasn't thinking about Xanadu when I said that, but Xanadu is not a good movie. There's no veil involved.
You know what? I'm just going to pull out my Blu-ray copy.
Don't pull out anything, Bill.
That Russell Bragg sent me.
I love your love of all things Olivia Newton-John. I think that's absolutely fantastic.
Love when she killed her fiancé?
He's just on a walkabout in the ocean somewhere. Maybe.
With Leslie Nielsen. He could hold his breath a very long time. And anybody who gets that reference, good for you.
Yeah. I had a theory... But I debunked the theory.
That it's a demon, a dancing demon.
Even.
No, something isn't right here.
Must be bunnies. No. And I don't think Paul will get that reference.
No, I don't.
Ah, it was the Buffy musical episode.
Again, back to musicals. You guys go there, but you know, I've never been.
We should make you watch that.
I've never been to me.
Ugh.
So. Anyway,
Andy, I'm just gonna totally veer off here. I got a little bit of a bone to pick with you and Steve.
Oh, go on.
When you do your top songs at the end of the Fantastic Cast,
yeah,
the two of you seem to have a real good time blasting Chicago. I love Chicago.
I don't even remember which one that was. What song was it?
It wasn't one of the best. I think it was If You Leave Me Now.
Oh, it's just middle of the road. Yeah.
Yeah, when they got into their ballad period in the 80s and in the late 70s, that was not the best of Chicago. But
no.
But I've seen what now constitutes Chicago in concert a couple of times, and I love them. I just think they're great.
That's fair.
And when you guys were talking about how bad it was, I was going to hop a flight over there and just bonk your heads together and fly back.
Music is like humor. It is very much of an individual person. And that's fine. You like Chicago, that's okay.
I'll take that as an apology.
Okay. Hey, you've got God Save the Queen coming up soon. Now that's a song.
Whatever.
Anyway, my theory for why we haven't had a Star Trek movie that I debunked while you guys were talking, was I was thinking, well, maybe they're waiting for Discovery to get out because they want to bring in some of the actors from the show. But then I was like, well, technically, that's not in the Kelvinverse universe, so maybe they won't do that, but maybe they will, so who knows? That was just my crazy
thought. I think if they're smart, they'll just keep the two totally separate. Mm-hmm. They will not refer to whether to which universe it's in and not care which universe it's in.
Yeah, I think they should just do that.
They've said on the record that it's the original timeline, but they don't need to clarify that any further.
No.
They never need to actually make reference to it in any way on the show.
Well, now that you've seen two more episodes, do you have any other changing, or are you
liking it? I'm enjoying it. I'm enjoying it very much.
Okay.
I think it's, it's funny how I'm enjoying that and the Orville at the same time, and they are two totally different looks at the same type of material.
So am I. I was considering doing a Palace of Glitter Delight, by the Orville versus Discoverer, but they're such completely different shows, you can't really do it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. They're very, very different.
So, but I'm enjoying the Orville as well. The most recent episode, where Lara Kitaine freezes when she sees fire in engineering, that was a really fun one.
Oh yeah, and then the rest of the didn't see the rest of the. I was wondering what was going on. Paul, have you seen that one?
I've seen. I think I'm 2 or 3 episodes behind right now.
All right. Then we won't give it away because I was like, oh, I didn't see that. Ooh, So yeah, we won't expound on it, but it was very what are you afraid of? And these people's fears keep popping up on the ship, and it was done. It was interesting. That's all we'll say.
Yeah,
for now.
I'll accept that.
All right then, should we get on with Hard Time?
Let's do that.
Convicted of a crime he didn't commit.
Welcome to hell.
Condemned to a sentence he cannot endure.
We punish our offenders by giving them memories of incarceration.
Confined in a prison he can never leave.
I don't belong here!
Chief O'Brien comes face to face.
You're unfit for duty.
With his toughest enemy.
It wasn't real.
It's real to me.
Himself. On the next Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Okay. Today's episode, as I've already mentioned at the top of the show, is Hard Time. It was directed by Alexander Singer, and the story was by Daniel Keyes Moran and Lynn Barker, with a teleplay by Robert Hewitt Wolfe. While visiting Agrathi, Chief of Operations Miles O'Brien asks too many questions and is convicted of espionage. Instead of incarcerating convicts, the Agrathi Correctional Facility implants them with memories of years of imprisonment and a few hours of actual time. O'Brien experiences 20 years in prison before his fellow officers can extract him from the situation. On returning to Deep Space Nine, O'Brien tries to adjust to life back on board the station, but his experience whilst imprisoned has troubling him, presenting as flashbacks to his time in jail. Seeing his wife Keiko initially as his fictional cellmate, Ichar, he begins to exhibit habitual behaviours that he picked up while incarcerated, such as hoarding food and sleeping on the hard floor instead of his bed. While playing darts with Commander Worf, O'Brien sees Ichar outside the bar, but when he tries to follow him outside, Ichar is nowhere to be seen. Over time, O'Brien becomes increasingly irritable and reclusive. When Dr. Bashir visits him, O'Brien tells him to stay the hell away from me. Whilst waiting to be served at Quark's bar, he assaults Quark. Immediately, across the table, O'Brien sees Ichar, who tells O'Brien he needs him. Quark and Constable Odo are seen observing O'Brien from across the bar. Captain Sisko later relieves O'Brien of duty, placing him on medical leave and ordering him to attend the counselling session that he'd been consistently avoiding. O'Brien storms into Dr. Bashir's infirmary, angry at being placed on leave, and telling Bashir that he just wants to be left alone. Again, he imagines seeing Ichar, who urges him to get help. But instead, he storms out and returns to his quarters. Keiko and their young daughter Molly are there, and O'Brien yells at them before almost hitting Molly. He flees to a cargo bay and starts tearing the place apart. Finding a weapons locker, he sets a phaser on maximum, preparing to take his own life. Bashir follows O'Brien and finds him just in time. Bashir recounts the story of how he'd killed Ichar over a few pieces of bread that Ichar was saving for both of them, and that the guilt has been eating away at his conscience. O'Brien is convinced that he is an animal, but Bashir tells him that if he truly were, he would have felt no regret for killing Ichar, and so O'Brien is still human deep down inside. Bashir ultimately prescribes a new course of heavy treatment, and soon O'Brien is on the way to recovery. The end. That synopsis wasn't particularly well written. Arguably, it wasn't particularly well read, but we'll, you know, you can blame me for that. I quite liked this one. I thought it was a nice exploration of guilt and PTSD, which strangely is what The Punisher is exploring on Netflix as well. I could have done without O'Brien's comedy beard in the pre-credit sequence, but
Monty
I think
Python beard.
Yeah, the Monty Python. It's
you wait for the it's.
Yeah, I was just expecting him to jump up and down naked. But I did enjoy it. I think it's exceptionally well acted by Cole Meany. I think it's incredibly brave to take a Star Trek character to the point of depression and suicide, which I also thought was very good. I don't think they really dealt with the idea that O'Brien was suicidal as well as perhaps they could have. Because, again, we're not really sequential just yet, because I don't believe this is ever mentioned again. But viewed as 45 minutes of television, it was actually a very well acted and very well written piece of Star Trek.
I think that your last qualifier is exactly what made this a better episode for me than it probably should be. When you said, viewed as a 45 minute episode of television.
Mm.
See, the problem with this one, as I see it, is they're trying to hit on a very, very complicated emotional state that would take a lot more than a 45 minute episode to explain and a lot more than a 45 minute episode to resolve. But they, you know, they're in a situation where they probably could not dedicate more to it than that. You really can't just have this as an ongoing subplot, and you're never going to be able to give all the intricacies and complexities of this type of situation. So they had to kind of just do the, you know, the greatest hits of what this would do to somebody and then move on. So giving it a little bit of rope for that, I do think it was really a good episode. I don't think somebody would be able to reintegrate themselves as quickly as that. And I think someone would have some problems even with their memories if in their mind it was 20 years ago before they experienced since they had experienced their regular life. So I do think there's a lot that they could have explored, but I just don't think they had the time to do it. And giving that as a qualifier, I do think this was a really gripping episode in its own way. William? Did we lose Bill?
Earth to Bill?
No, I'm here. I was wondering what that background noise was.
That was just our washing machine cycling.
Oh, I was like, who's on a plane?
Let's just finish it.
Okay, sorry. Yeah, this is a deep one. They do kind of bring up though, because they said that O'Brien's been through a lot, and they referenced a few other, you know, were these direct references to other shows where he's been tortured?
Yes.
That's
definitely.
What I wasn't sure of.
There's definitely a reference to The Wounded, which was the Next Generation episode with, what's his name, Bob Gunther in it?
Oh, okay, the captain of the other ship that he had to, like, talk down from attacking...
Yeah, from attacking the Cardassians.
Right, but he
wasn't willing to let the war end.
Right, but he's ultimately, you know, was right.
Yeah. But they have also established as well in Deep Space Nine that O'Brien has a deep resentment of the Cardassians because of the war, and he isn't perhaps over that as well. And I'm just looking on Memory Alpha, And it does, or the other references are to the Deep Space Nine episodes Whispers and Tribunal.
Yeah.
So they were references to previous O'Brien stories. Yeah, see, I think we're all probably going to be in agreement on this one, to be honest with you. I think depression isn't something that is wrapped up quickly in 45 minutes. And I think that if we were looking for that to be explored a little bit deeper, then this isn't the episode.
Well, there is some passage of time in this episode. It's subtle, and you'll miss it if you're not, you know, if you don't go back and watch it, you know, as many times as we do. Because I had seen this quite a few weeks ago, and then rewatched it last night, and only last night realized that there was some passage of time after he gets back to the station.
Yeah, there is a bit of time going past.
You're still limited to 45 minutes to tell the story.
And I think it was actually quite interesting of Deep Space Nine to even tackle this, given that, you know, Chain of Command had Picard tortured and he was back to normal before the end of the episode. And he was essentially raped by the Borg, and he was over that within one episode because of family. So the fact that Deep Space Nine even went to this well to try and tackle something as important as PTSD and depression in 20 years ago is quite rare. It's only in the past couple of years we even talked about male depression and male anxiety, and it being something that men, we just don't talk about. We just kind of get on with it.
That's kind of depressing.
Yeah, it is. Badum-cha.
But so I'm going to just interrupt you, Andy, and say that, and I give them a tip of the hat, that when they did First Contact, which we mentioned earlier, they do go back to that. Picard still has some PTSD from the Borg thing.
Yeah, but in First Contact, my only problem with it is it hadn't been addressed at all for the remaining 4 years of Next Generation.
I understand and I agree, but I would have hated if they just kept harping on it for 4 years also.
They don't have to harp on it. They're just one line in future episodes. O'Brien comes in from work, and she says, "You're late, honey," and he just goes, "Oh yeah, I've been seeing the counselor." Just establish that he's carrying on with his treatment, and he's seeing whoever it is he needs to see. Because the only thing that I felt about this episode that was a little bit rough was at the end, Chief Dr. Bashir just basically says, "Oh, I'll just give you more medicine."
I was just going to say, here are some psychotropic drugs, and go see your counselor.
Yeah, and you'll be fine.
You'll be good as new, Chief.
So it's a very heavy one as well. There's very little in the way of subplots in this one, is there?
I don't understand why he didn't want to talk to Julian. Why he was like,
I think that's part of the PTSD. I think you start becoming a little defensive. You become embarrassed about what's going on in your life. You get, you want to feel like you have total control, even though you don't.
I think it's
a very complex thing.
No, I mean, after he's had the breakdown and Julian got him down off the ledge, he's already made a connection with him. He's always his friend. I don't understand why, instead of seeing the counselor, why he didn't just see Julian at the end
I'm gonna go with that a little further. I think it's a very complex thing, and I think that it's different for every person, first of all, if you go through something like that. And I thankfully don't have PTSD or depression, or at least not that I know of. But I think some people would accept counseling from a loved one. Some people would not. Some people would need a total stranger to kind of work with them on it. So I think it's very unique to the individual. I don't think things like that can be all put into one bucket and say, this is how you handle it. And that's one of the things about what you just said, where I'm not so crazy about the idea of, here's a psychotropic drug, you're fine. You know, I think it's a long battle, and I think everybody needs different things to get out of it. So, you know, and that's my layperson's lame view of things, but I think it may be accurate.
Yeah, well, like I said, I don't know if anyone's been watching The Punisher on Netflix, but one of the through lines of that is that all of the characters are suffering some kind of PTSD, and they're all dealing with it in different ways. And The Punisher is able to devote a number of episodes to this because it's a Netflix show. So its exploration of it and what it does to people is obviously a lot deeper than this is. But again, television was different 20 years ago when this was made. So again, like I just said, I think they do deserve some credit for even tackling this issue at the time, because it's not something Star Trek's really explored before. And it is this idea as well that for O'Brien to have killed that guy is a major trauma for him. It's not just, you know, he walks around with a phaser and guns loads of people down on a regular basis. And he was in war, so he knows that people have to die or people will get killed. So the fact that this one death affected him so much is really interesting and really, I was going to say well explored, but it's not really in depth in its exploration. But it does at least attempt to have a look at that issue and explore it with a character that probably is the most relatable to the audience. O'Brien essentially is us. He's not a doctor, he's not a captain, he's not a Klingon, he's not a Trill. He's the everyman. He is the arguably the only one since maybe Scotty, possibly Geordi, that comes across as just being a normal guy doing a job.
There was two things that left me wondering about the Agrathi people. Well, not really, why are they so paranoid, but is this... Okay, if he was an actual Agrathi citizen, would he have been shown or treated for this if he stayed on the... You know, do they just do this to their citizens and just throw them back out on the street? And maybe this is their way of getting rid of their own undesirables, you know, that, yeah, we're going to put you in prison in your mind for 20 years, and then you're, you know, we figure you're just going to fall apart as a person, and you may end up offing yourself, so we don't have to. Like, it's an easy way of them to, well, oh, well, he did it to himself. We didn't. Oh, it was all in his mind. You know, it's not our fault that he killed himself.
See, I think I'm sorry, Bill. Keep finishing.
You know, or do they treat their people that they do this to? I had more questions. You know, I was like, wow, you know, like, would this be a viable treatment, you know, for prisoners if we had this in our own society? What would we do with it to our...
It's a very interesting point, because there's an element of the criminal justice system where they believe that, you know, you pay for your crime, you do your time, and you're rehabilitated.
Yeah.
But I do think there's an element of it where people cannot, there are certain people who cannot be rehabilitated. So you're doing society a favor by keeping them off the streets for 20 years. You know what I mean? In this instance, you're making them feel like they've done the 20 years of punishment, but then you're putting them back on the street while they're still young and vital enough to commit more crimes. So if they're not rehabilitated, you're endangering society to that extent. Now, I mean, that's a slippery slope there, because then what are you going to say? Nobody's ever rehabilitated? But maybe they need to actually examine the person and come up with a conclusion as to whether or not there's some level of rehabilitation. Because if there isn't, maybe releasing them is the worst thing you could do. Now you've just put somebody through hard time, probably made them more violent, and put them out there while they're still young enough to act on it. You know, at least in the other instance where you really do it, by the time that 20 years is over, you know, you're an older person and you really can't do as much physically. You know, I think it's a very harsh way to look at things, but I think, again, we're down to a case-by-case basis. If you're just going to automatically say everybody's rehabilitated after they do their time, I think that's too simple-minded a way of looking at things.
Which goes back into the problem that we had with the fact that as 45 minutes, this is good, but there is a feeling that there's more exploration to be had here. And
there is, but can you dedicate more than 45 minutes of DS9 to this subject?
No, because that's not what Deep Space Nine's about. You can argue a case that The Punisher is about that, because you're exploring that not only through Frank Castle, but also through other characters in the show. So you can make those 13 episodes partially about that. The Punisher's about a whole lot of other stuff as well. It's probably one of the more fascinatingly written of the Netflix series, even though some of the inter-episode stuff's quite weak. But Deep Space Nine isn't that show. Deep Space Nine's not about soldiers with PTSD and depression. Deep Space Nine is a whole other animal. So again, judging it by 45 minutes of TV 20 years ago, it's gripping and daring and dark and bleak and brave. By the standards of today, it's not as bleak or gripping or as brave as it was then. But that's doing it a disservice, because it wasn't made now, it was made 20 years ago. So on the standards of the time, it's a very good episode and a very interesting and enduring one. I just don't think, certainly I can't completely adjust to the fact that, you know, since this was made, we've moved on an awful lot in storytelling, and storytelling in television specifically. So it's kind of hard to look at it now in isolation and say, well, O'Brien would be feeling the effects of this for the rest of the series run. Essentially, for all intents and purposes, the guy is now 20 years older. How would that affect him? But the show isn't about Chief O'Brien and his depression. So we're just going to move on and do other stuff. And I think you just have to accept it. And just accept that as a standalone episode, this is great. Next week, it's the Mirror Universe.
Mm. Well, how would that affect, like, so he's got 20 more years worth of memories in his head with that. How would that affect him?
Yeah.
That's like Picard in the inner light.
I mean, just.
Yeah. How would it affect his relationship with his wife, with his daughter, with his co-workers? He comes back to work after 20 years. There's a very real possibility he's going to forget stuff that he knew just yesterday. His passwords, for God's sake, I don't remember a password after a weekend away from work.
This yeah, guy's been away for 20 years. Think about it this way. What is O'Brien at this point? Maybe around 40?
Yeah. Yeah, so now he has the mind
so
of 60.
So mentally, he's 60.
Yeah, yep. That's what
physically, he's still like 40, but mentally, he's 60.
Right, and that he
and
has
he's just been 20 years away from his family.
Yeah, well, not just that, but what his mind physically think it's 60, or could there be like he has all the that stored neuron energy in his mind is what I'm getting at. It's like,
well, you're getting to psychological things that I can't even imagine. But can you compartmentalize that information and create some sort of a mental block to say that never really happened? I have these memories, but I understand it never happened, and they're not actual events in my life.
Oh, I doubt it. You would always.
No, you can't do that. Stuff happened to you, and it's a part of you, and it forms who you are as a person, good and bad. And essentially, for all intents and purposes, now Chief O'Brien is 20 years older than he is physically. Unless Dr. Bashir can wave some magic wand and remove 20 years worth of memories from him. And we have done that. Didn't Dr. Pulaski move somebody's memories in Next Generation?
I don't know. What Bashir
said here,
Dumbledore to do it.
That he couldn't do it, though.
Yeah. But,
yeah, it's just you know, this is, and we've talked about this so many times, this is one of the best things about Star Trek, is it's a simple episode, effectively. You watch it, you enjoy it, it's over. But then when you start talking about it, you come up with all these things that it's like, well, how could you do that? You know, how does this work? Or what's the answer to this question? And I love it when these episodes do this. You know, you could, after 20 years, you know, in theory, he could walk up to Keiko and say, I don't even know who you are anymore, really. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you, you know, I'm no longer in love because 20 years have gone by. You know, you're no longer a part of my life. That could happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, when he comes back, he forgot his wife was pregnant. You know, that's one of the things he says. He's like, you're pregnant. I forgot. You know, and when he's with Ichar, I think we need to discuss Ichar, too. But we'll get to
Ichar
that.
Ichar always had a dopey look on his face. Well, I would have killed him, too. Now, was Ichar another prisoner, or was Ichar just a memory implant?
I think Ichar was something that, well,
he really kill somebody?
They said, well, in his mind he did.
No, he didn't. Yeah, because none of this is real. Okay. So he hasn't really killed anybody.
I think Ichar was a figment of his imagination to help him. Like, it was because they say that it's designed for the individual, and I think it was they pulled it out of his head. And it was meant to be a coping, you know, a thing to help. Like, he might have created Ichar to help himself cope, but even after 20 years, you know.
Well, that was my next question, was Ichar something that just developed in the course of this program, or is Ichar a part of the program that they had, you know, that they put in there for him? You know, we're gonna give you a cellmate and see how you react to it.
Well, Ichar was there from the beginning too, so But even, you know, he grows tired of him.
Tired of you.
But did you recognize the actor?
No.
It took.
He was. I didn't. He was most known to me from the movie The Stuntman.
He was.
Also in Body Double, but he was. I know him from The Stuntman.
Stuntman. Really? He was in The Stuntman? I thought that was Rails Back.
Unless I'm mistaken. In which case, I just made a fool out of myself, and I'm going to edit it out.
Because I got his... Hold on, let me pull him up on IMDb.
Stuntman, 1980.
That was... I don't think that's the same guy.
You know, to Steve Railsback, you're right, I'm going to have to edit this out.
Yeah, because Railsback was in Life Force with Patrick Stewart.
I am
a walking tiny IMDb. Life
Force.
It's so sad.
Life Force.
Okay, so then he's from Body Double.
Yeah, he was the guy that is macking on the chick across the way and sees her murdered. Maybe.
He was also in Nightmare on Elm Street 3.
Yep, mm-hmm. He was in Ghost Story. He was the English professor that finds out he's trying to get it on with a ghost.
I'm guessing he's retired now, because his last thing in his filmography was 2006.
Yeah, it doesn't say he's passed away, so...
No, it's... So I assume he's still... I would hope well, but he's apparently no longer working.
But watching this again last night, there was like one little scene that really caught my attention when he's sitting in Quark's bar and he's talking with him. This is after he gets back to the station, and he's now hallucinating HR as he's walking around the station and seeing him. And HR comes and he's talking to him after he almost snapped Quark's wrist. Which haven't we all wanted to do that when you wanted to get a drink at a bar? Hey, I'm right here. Give me my freaking drink, would you? Of course, maybe I've got a little stress that I've got to deal with in my life. But
Easy.
Oh, back down, buddy. So he's sitting across from the table and... It's one quick scene, and it's while HR is talking to O'Brien, and he says something to him about you need me as a friend, and he flicks his index finger. His hands are on the table, and when he goes and says you need me as a friend, he flicks his finger like he's pointing to him. It's real subtle. It's real subtle. I mean, one actor might have just left his hands on the table, but he had like this. He had a lot of physicality to his acting. I thought little subtle things that just really drew me into him as a character. You know, maybe I wouldn't have snapped HR's neck. You know.
I would have snapped his neck like the first day.
Hey, he was helping him draw the little things in the sand, you know, showed him how to hide the bread and the stuff. The chalala fruit, whatever they called it. Chelsea fruit.
Chelsea fruit. Yeah.
That funny bread stuff that they were eating. Didn't look like bread, did it?
Oh, man. When he opened up that thing, it looked like there was a heart in there. I was like, ew. Of course, 20 years, you know. You gotta eat what you gotta eat.
Yeah, I suppose so.
Everyone's gotta eat. Anyway. So, yeah, it's like I said, I just think this was overall... You know, really positive in that it gave us a lot to think about.
Yeah.
I wonder, as I'm sure everybody does, what would Blaine say? Bill, sing us in.
Blaine says. What does Blaine say?
We really need a clip to put there, but until then, I'll just have you sing.
Okay.
Blaine says, hi, guys. Well, we're moving away from last week's episode about a regular cast member's trial and punishment for a crime that took place before the show's opening teaser and moving on to... An episode about a regular cast member's trial and punishment for a crime that took place before the show's opening teaser. Of course, in this case, we have a rare element that sets it apart from every other such episode of Star Trek, in particular, and dramas in general. The regular cast member is actually guilty. Granted, it's of a crime that our culture wouldn't consider a crime, but this exaggerated definition of espionage is at least more plausible than the death penalty for stepping on flowers. If anything, my only complaint about this episode is that it only takes O'Brien one episode to deal with the issues he's faced with. I still can't believe that they had a Starfleet officer contemplate suicide. well outside of some weird sense of Klingon honor. Not a big piece of the big picture, though it really should be, but utterly riveting. Yeah, I mean, I think that kind of capsulizes what we've said a little bit, that, you know, they kind of had to do this in 45 minutes, which doesn't really do the subject matter justice, but I think it came down to do it in 45 minutes or don't do it at all. And I would rather they took the former.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep.
Right now, we do not have any email to read. Actually, though, we shouldn't even get onto email yet because we haven't rated this episode. Unless you guys have anything more you'd like to discuss about it.
There was something and I lost it. I'll see if it comes back to me.
Okay.
So, you want to rate it, Andy?
I think this is a solid 4.
You know, don't mince words, just tell us.
No, I think for the time that it was made and the topic that it's tackling, it was very interesting and brave piece of television. And you don't really want to judge it by today's standards because it was 20 years ago. So I think Cole Meany's central performance was fantastic.
See, I'm also giving it a 4. I had originally rated it as a 3.5, and I upgraded it based on our conversation about it and how many thoughts it provoked.
Mm.
And frankly, I don't think I have the same issue with it that you do, Andy, where you keep having to say, well, you got to judge it by the time it was produced. I think just as a regular episode, even if it came out today, it might be done differently if it was done today. Mm. But I still think this episode, even by today's standards, is thought-provoking and a solid episode. So I'm giving it a 4 with no qualifier.
Okay.
I remembered what I was going to say. So does Starfleet or the Federation not have some type of like legal corps or something that when you come to a new planet, you know, you set up like, you know, like, well, to do a quote from Lethal Weapon 2, diplomatic immunity. I mean, come on. Stepping on flowers, death penalty. Oh, look. Hey, that's a nice watch you have there. Lock him up! Lock him up! I mean, come on, people.
Well, if you like going to a planet where they have social media and they gave you enough downvotes that you... Oh, wait.
Oh, whoops. Oh, yeah. Wrong show. But still, it's like they're...
You would think there would be a little bit of an advanced scouting to let you know, but then again, they are exploring. Well, but TNG's 9 isn't really an exploration show. I don't know.
I mean, you would think there'd be some, you know, hey, is there things we should do, things we shouldn't do? You know, when you beam down and you talk to somebody, you just don't look
them directly in the eye, because that's a challenge, and you'll have to fight Aka-Ar.
The planet of the Tom Cruises. Never make eye contact.
I just called the Klingon a coward.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, in the original series, they just beam down in the middle of the square. Hey, everybody!
You know? But in that episode, they actually had Bones be the guy who went down and examined the culture and told them all what to do.
Yeah.
The one with Ma'ab and Aka-Ar.
Mm. He smacks Julie Newmar. I'm not laughing because he smacked the woman before we get hate mail. More hate mail.
A
pregnant woman.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Jeez.
Not that I'm throwing you under a bus, right?
Thanks.
But any hate mail to be sent to Dr. Bill Robinson at...
Well, beep, beep, beep. The back of the truck up now. Great. That's awesome. Oh, 4. That's my rating. 4, 4 hunks of half-eaten bread.
Okay. If that was indeed bread.
Ew. Well, it looked like one of those, you know, it looked like some, what is it?
Like the croutons.
Brown, the brown bread, the pumpernickel bread?
Yeah, okay.
Pumpernickel. The shout out to Luke Giaconetti. He'll get it.
Oh, okay. Job's a good
one. What? Huh?
Job's a good one. Job's a good one. Well done. What? We're finished. Done.
Oh. It's like, what are you speaking Swedish all of a sudden?
Do you people not speak English?
English man.
Queen,
do you
we don't speak
it?
The Queen's English.
Job's a good'un.
Never heard that.
You know. Next, you were telling me you don't know what a fortnight is.
Isn't that
two
like...
weeks.
There you go.
Yeah, something like that. But why is it
days.
Got a four in it?
That's why it's easy to remember for me. 14 days, fortnight.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I get it now. I understand.
Job's a good'un. All right, are we doing the book?
We can, or we can do it next time.
It's up to you.
It's up to you guys. I'm good.
My point is minuscule. I have no problem with it if you guys want to do it.
Well, this time around, we're going to do Chapter 11 of Deep Space Nine, Stitch in Time.
My part is huge.
It's not a reflection of manhood, Andy.
I was going to say, that sounds like there's... other connotations in there that I'm not going to bring up.
And my role in this particular play that we will be enacting is significantly larger than yours.
Again, it sounds like you're bringing up manhood.
They always told me that size doesn't matter.
Did you get the script and count how many pages you were on, Andy?
It's a 5-page script.
He's the William Shatner of listening.
So I'm lying.
Am I on the first page or the last page, right?
Yeah. Yeah, okay. I'm on every page.
I think...
every page. Baby, look at me.
I'm just saying, I should get paid more money.
You do.
I'm
what,
on
twice
Eric...
nothing is still nothing? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. I'm on... I am also on every page. Paul's only on 4 out of 5 right, pages.
All right.
I got a line at the top of page 5. Andy's got a lot.
I have. So, do we want to do it?
Yeah, sure. So we are doing a reading of Chapter 11 because it's a dialogue between Garak, Odo, and Bashir on the promenade.
It's Chapter 11, bankruptcy.
Yeah, you've got 11 or 7 of 9. Ba-dum-cha.
The other day, the Doctor, Odo, and I were at the Replimat having lunch, an event that Odo, after our conversation, had taken it upon himself to organise. The station grows more tense each day the invasion is put off. The fabric of community interaction is wearing thin and flaring tempers and no longer confined to quarks. Indeed, after my situation, the promenade witnessed several such incidents. Every day we look for signs that might indicate who will be assigned where, for what duty and when. Each day we're disappointed, and the tension is further bloated with rumours that range from the plausible to the wildly fantastic. As the casualty figures mount, some of us attempt to keep the prevailing sense of doom at arm's length, with what the Doctor calls gallows humour.
The one I heard this morning was about you, Garak.
It was clear from Odo's expression that he'd been looking forward to this moment.
I was warned that not only were you a changeling, but that the reason you spent so much time in the Replimat was you had found a way to slowly poison us all.
I'm sure the Replimat is quite capable of doing that without my help. I was only half joking.
That must be the same person who came to me and accused you of sowing a deadly toxin into his shirt.
Ah, yes, I remember him. He didn't want to pay for the shirt. And I did remember him. Another Bajoran who thought he could alleviate his troubles by targeting the Cardassian tailor.
When I did an analysis of the shirt, I found nothing but traces of his own bodily fluids.
Which were toxic only to the people in his immediate presence. I added just before a fight broke out in the food line. Two Romulans had decided that waiting in line was beneath their dignity, and the others were vigorously disagreeing. Odo did not appreciate the interruption and gave our new allies a blunt lesson in station etiquette. They left with sneering disdain. With friends like that. Odo sat down and gave me a look.
Humph.
It was Captain Sisko's idea to get the Romulans involved, Odo, not mine. I answered the look.
Humph.
But what about you, Doctor? I asked, returning to the business at hand. It seems there's a movement afoot to have you replace Captain Sisko. The Doctor winced.
Is this true?
We both looked to the Doctor for confirmation. He sighed.
Well, there is a group of genetically enhanced people who feel that one of their own should be guiding the station during this emergency, and they've petitioned the Federation Council, but it's Jack and his group, and no one takes them... Garak, how did you hear about this?
My clientele talk and I listen. This was also true. An idiot savant who wears his presumed genetic superiority like a badge of privilege walked into my shop and never stopped talking. Of course, I encouraged him, and by the time he left, I had heard all about some organized attempt to elevate Dr. Bashir to the leadership position. I could see that the doctor was upset that I divulged this information. Clearly, this genetic business was not his favorite topic of conversation.
Is this something we should keep an eye on?
No, no, not at all. It's just Jack's people. This was nearly a year ago, and I'm afraid they have too much time on their hands, like some other people I know.
He pointedly looked away from me as Odo continued to study us, trying to decode the undercurrent of this last exchange between us. No wonder he was such a capable security operative. Odo registered every change in tone and temperature and tracked the change down to its cause.
Tell me something, Garrick.
It was clear that he had found an opening for one of those deferred questions he kept on a prioritized list somewhere in his changeling head. He was still a basically shy and tactful person, especially when it came to other people's business, but lately he'd become more openly inquisitive. I wondered if it was Major Kira's influence. Certainly, Constable, I replied.
If Cardassia remains within the Dominion sphere, would you stay on the station?
Judging from the sartorial styles, I gestured to the crowded room, I'd say a good tailor is a necessity. I smiled, not believing for a moment that I'd survive an aborted invasion of Cardassia, or that there would still be a Deep Space Nine if we failed. This must be the lunch where we deal with uncomfortable subjects.
But if Cardassia is liberated from Dominion control...
When Cardassia is liberated, I interrupted.
Would you return?
Would you return to the Great Link? Odo reacted with sharp annoyance to the question. It wasn't a fair one, because although we were both exiles, we were in very different circumstances. With the humanoid shape he was still learning to live with and his deepening relationship with Major Kira, Odo was discovering a new mode of existence, a new link. He had an alternative, however difficult the choice. I didn't. Yes, I know. You can't stay. I was sorry I'd asked again. It was a question he was obviously struggling with.
Would you return to the same Cardassia?
What do you mean, same? But I knew perfectly well what he meant.
To a Cardassia containing the political and social elements that made the current situation possible?
My dear Doctor, that's also the Cardassia that made me possible. I half-hoped my joke would end this conversation, but I knew better.
Yes, certainly, but given its totalitarian bent, do you really believe that the previous regime served its people? Liberation might allow for a new government that would ensure the freedom and well-being of its citizens, one that was based upon democratic principles.
I made no reply. We've had our clashes on the subject of Earth-style democracy during previous lunches. Dr. Bashir was of the opinion that the Cardassian political system allowed too many competing groups, especially the Military Central Command and the Obsidian Order, to function in secret and above the will of the people. No one was surprised when the Dietapar Council, the ruling civilian authority, overthrew Central Command, and very few people certainly mourned the demise of the Obsidian Order. But while I didn't disagree entirely with the Doctor's analysis, I found it somewhat simplistic. One cannot understand a political system detached from its societal context. I also found his eagerness to promote these political remedies somewhat condescending, but I knew the good Doctor was on a mission, and I was determined to show good manners and let him make his case.
With your background and experience, Garrick, I'm certain that you could serve as a liaison between a new Cardassian government and the Federation. I once suggested that you visit Earth as a member of the Cardassian government in exile.
Laughter erupted from my mouth. I truly couldn't stop it. Forgive me, Doctor, but the people who call themselves our government in exile wouldn't have me to lunch, and I wouldn't let them clean my shoes.
But you see, that's the problem. Each group has its own agenda. You're all so busy finding reasons to dislike each other that you don't have the will or the energy to find common ground. You're so dedicated to your...
reptilian mindset, I prompted.
Well, yes.
I laughed again, but inside I was beginning to lose patience with the analysis.
You are, Garrick. Democratic principles, on the other hand, are about adjusting boundaries, negotiating these differences, finding some kind of consensus.
Your common ground. No one could accuse me of not listening, especially to the key phrases.
Yes, because without common ground, there's nothing left except a kind of selfish interest that eventually leads to anarchy. Don't you see? That's why the Dominion found Cardassia to be easy pickings.
I looked over at Odo. He was nodding in appreciative agreement as if he'd learned something new and interesting. Indeed, there were several people at adjoining tables who were hanging onto the Doctor's passionate words as if he'd been anointed not just leader of the station, but saviour of the Alpha Quadrant. Of course, they loved his analysis of the evil Cardassian Empire.
That's why I urge you to go to Earth and experience firsthand a democracy that has evolved and united so many disparate groups.
I had had enough. First of all, Doctor, I don't quite know what you mean by democratic principles. Are you referring to the appalling lack of discipline and self-control I've observed on this station? The exaltation of individual freedom above the welfare of the group? The fact that the first among equals in a democratic society seems to get preference and privilege?
You mean you spy?
That's enough.
That's another principle, is it not, Doctor? I gestured to the crowd. Free expression of one's opinion?
Yes, it is, Garrick.
Educate me, Doctor, please. I'm obviously in the dark about these principles. What about the shabby manner in which certain acts of public service are ignored because they don't measure up to ethical Federation standards? Is that also a principle? Whereas lying, cheating, and stealing seem to be encouraged and amply rewarded as long as they keep the wheels of commerce turning and bring in a profit. You see, my friend, I'm somewhat confused. One man's democratic principle seems to be another man's political and social nightmare. My voice had risen to an uncharacteristic pitch. It was still ringing in my ears as the Doctor stared at me as if he was studying a baffling microbe. I too was baffled. I had no idea where this outpost came from. I know that a distance had widened between us during the past year or so, and I know that the holoswitch program incident and the revelation of his genetic enhancement are the symptoms of this distance, rather than the cause. It's only natural. We're very different people. I also know that he had only the best intentions in suggesting I use the Federation model in order to influence the future of Cardassia. Misguided, yes, and somewhat patronizing and arrogant, but hardly sufficient to elicit this embarrassing and public loss of control. I mumbled some sad excuse, which the good Doctor and Odo were kind enough to not challenge, and left the Lepromat. The Lepromat? And left the Replomat to return to my shop. As I passed Quarks, I caught his eye, and we nodded. Why I included him in my outburst also puzzled me. I rather admire his industry and resourcefulness. I especially admire the way he consistently bends Federation rules so they work for him. Back in the shop, I shut the doors and tried to work on an outfit I'd started to cut and come up with some designs for Odo. That brown uniform of his is so drab. I was pleased when he decided to take my advice and ask about something more stylish. What's going on with me? Surely it's not about Captain Sisko ignoring my contribution to the Romulan solution. I knew better. The reward for work well done is work itself. I'd been included in the invasion of Cardassia space, regardless of how limited its ambition and scope are when it takes place. The rest of it, recognition, medals, monuments, not really important to me. What is important is that I feel that I am necessary, that I function with all my faculties in the service of a greater cause. And while I wait for this invasion, is making Odo more attractive to Major Kira a greater cause? I threw down my sketches. I didn't want to stay in the shop with these colliding thoughts. But as I was about to leave, I was stopped in my tracks. I knew it was Odo's question. What will I do if Cardassia remained in Dominion control? Where would I go? The Doctor's interruption prevented me from answering, but truly, I have no answer. I don't know where I'd go. Much more troubling to me, however, is another question. Will I have a home if Cardassia is liberated?
Bravo! Bravo!
Are podcasts eligible for spoken word Grammys?
Dramatic reading.
That was the best hump I've ever heard.
And the award for best hump on a podcast goes to...
I wanted it to be a harumph.
I didn't get a harumph out of you.
You're editing it. You can do a retake.
That is true. I think I will leave it as is, though.
Well, next time we'll be on Chapter 12, which I haven't read yet. So I'll have to get cracking.
Alright.
That was fun.
That was. I think it was pretty cool. And I'm glad I had a little part. Because I probably would have stumbled if I had a bigger one.
Everybody picked their parts, so...
Yeah, no, I just said I was glad I had a little part. Why does that make you think I'm complaining?
No. It's for the audience. I don't want them to think, how come Paul got the short shrift?
Paul doesn't get the short shrift. Paul edits.
That's true.
Paul has the hard job.
When it's all done, it's going to seem like starring Paul.
I mean, you know, how do you think, since he does editing, that's how he gets that deep, voice that he has, and he makes us sound like little mice people. Andy wouldn't know because he never listens to the shows.
I use the Ray Romano voice modulator. Alright, so I guess that's it for this episode. But you know what? I wonder what we're going to do next time.
Next time, our all-new episode of Listen to the Prophets, we're journeying back to the Mirror Universe for Shattered Mirror. Ooh, Kira in leather.
Ah, oh, another 7 years bad luck.
In an alternate universe...
Welcome back, Captain.
...where chaos rules, one man has turned his back on the Federation.
Is he going to help us or not?
Now, Sisko must lead a rebellion.
I'll take the helm.
Against the most ruthless tyrant of them all. Worf.
I want that ship destroyed now!
One more hit could finish him.
On the next Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Well, I always look forward to Mirror Universe episodes, so we'll see you all then.
Goodbye!
That's my bread!
Listen to the Prophets, a Deep Space Nine podcast, is a Two True Freaks presentation. It is hosted by Andrew Leyland and Paul Spataro. The music and sound clips used in the show are copyright CBS and Paramount Entertainment. If you like to buy stuff from Amazon, and who doesn't, why not drop by the twotruefreaks.com website, where if you click the little link that we have there, it will take you straight through that site, and whilst it won't cost you any extra, we'll put a few shekels in our tip jar, which helps create content like this. We very much hope you enjoyed listening to The Prophets. Every episode is dedicated to the memory of our pal, Sean Engel.
Crack.
You had to put in the crack. I forgot about that.
I had to break your neck. It was the only way out of the situation.
True. Yeah. It's the only way I could resolve this.